Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
My name is Adrian Garcia-Ranos. I'm the president of Endeavor Global.
Adrian, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we talk about the Endeavor and your current role in the organization, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date.
My career, I always define myself a bit of a mutt because I've done so many different things. You know? So I studied political science in Spain. Then I went on to working in finance in the trading floor for quite a few years. Realized that I didn't really like that. So ended up going to foreign trade. Did that for a while. That actually landed me in the U.S. Ended up working in the U.S. thinking I would spend a year at most, maybe two. And fell in love with the country. Found another job at The Economist. Was able to develop a very interesting career and be able to expose to fascinating people while I was there, which actually gave me a trajectory. And then I started building out. From there, I went on to J.P. Morgan. And then when I was happily in J.P. Morgan working in what I considered back then my dream job, I got this call from Endeavor if I wanted to launch the office in Spain, which had been a project that had been in the works for the last 2-3 years. And after a lot of back and forth, I went for it because it entailed a lot of new things. It entailed moving back to Spain. It entailed setting up a new operation and leaving the security of working for a large institution like J.P. Morgan. No? But I took it on, and I actually never looked back ever since. That's been 7.5 years ago. And for the last 2.5 years, I've been the president of the organization.
Well, that's super exciting. Yeah, that's great. And thanks for that background. Very diverse, experience from going, in political science and also, all kinds of different areas, which is very exciting. So tell me a little bit more about Endeavor. How did you come about actually the idea, what the mission of the organization, and what are you guys trying to accomplish?
So the idea, it goes back to 24 years ago. Both Peter Kellner and Linda Rotenberg founded this. They were basically based at that point out of Argentina and Chile. And actually it was that they set up both of those offices more or less at the same time. And the idea was to support these small business owners. There was not really a word for entrepreneurship, emprendimiento, back then in Spanish, no? So they basically were founding these, they were supporting these young entrepreneurs that were starting up with these small businesses. Many of them were tech-based, so we're talking about the end of the 90s, a lot of tech-based companies, no? They were onto something, but they were in an emerging market, so they didn't have access to, definitely have no access to the talent and to the capital. And the resources that their peers in the U.S. had, but there were still absolutely amazing opportunities, in fintech and in e-commerce and so forth. So they started with that in Argentina essentially, and have built it up from that moment on. No, and fast forward 24 years, we're now present in 39 markets, supporting entrepreneurs with the exact same spirit. With what I think it's now 2,300 entrepreneurs or plus actually, which represent roughly 1,300 companies worldwide. But the idea was basically very easy. By supporting these entrepreneurs, we are supporting the development of those local economies. No? And it's something that right now is really embedded in our day-to-day. We know that by selecting the best entrepreneurs, the ones that are gonna really scale and make a huge difference, we know that by doing that, we're automatically supporting the local ecosystems. Why? Because it's not only the job creation and the direct wealth that is generated by these companies, but also all the indirect, or what we call the multiplier effect these companies have, which would be, one, the amount of entrepreneurs that come out of entrepreneurial founders. They see that this entrepreneur thing is something that is feasible, I could do it myself, and they have their own idea, so they leave their companies and set up something else. These entrepreneurs may come across some money at some point. So when they come across some money, they will actually reinvest most likely in the ecosystem, being angel investors at one point, and then maybe even structuring funds at another. They become obviously role models in their local ecosystems, that inspire all these entrepreneurs. And all of a sudden you see that this whole, this whole world is actually spinning out of this idea that came from 1, 2, 3, 4 people, And it becomes really the catalyst of what a very dynamic ecosystem can be, And then you have all these concepts of when in the U.S. we know as the PayPal mafia, all those mafia-like entities or formations actually come together, and you see all the effects that the Rappi mafia or the Gojek mafia or the different ones in the different parts of the world. And always, by the way, mafia in the best of terms. So in the network component kind of term.
Right. No, absolutely. That's very interesting. And I'm pretty sure we can spend probably the rest of the episode talking about that particular concept. That's very interesting. So in essence, and you know, that it's very interesting to me because as a founder operator, entrepreneur of multiple companies of myself, I've launched many companies. I successfully failed a lot of them. I had success with a couple of them, but now I'm basically kind of transitioning into this kind of mentor, advisor, and also angel investor into a lot of startups, kind of exactly the journey that you were talking about with some of the graduates that you have, and just passing on that experience, you know, from fundraising to growing the companies, because a lot of people helped me when I was going through that journey. So tell me a little bit more from a standpoint of just the overall industry that you're serving with Endeavor. What are the different trends that you're seeing in the market? What are you mostly excited about? What are you researching these days?
I mean, let's see, we're sector agnostic, so we're excited about everything and anything. No, I mean, we see a lot of going on. We see a lot that's going on lately in food tech, so food tech is very exciting. We see some opportunities as well in the industrial side, so the more of the construction, but applying technology to that part of it, and there's more and more that's being done there as well. And then the traditional areas there's still a long way to go. So there is obviously opportunity still in fintech and still in other areas, but those are the more, I guess you'd say, the more common ones, the ones that you read more about. But I'd say that things around industrial production and things around the food tech space, those have been quite exciting. And there's also been an emergence of the insurtech space as well. All the breaking the barriers of insurance and the opportunity that lies there. But there's definitely been opportunity there. And then as far as geographies go, we also see huge opportunities in different areas. We've been, for the last year, we've been talking about the amazing point in which Mexico is at. And sure enough, in the last 8 months, we have already 2 unicorns. Most likely we'll have a couple more by the end of the year. Egypt is at a beautiful point right now too, as far as entrepreneurial ecosystem goes. And I would highlight obviously Vietnam too, and Indonesia as well. But Indonesia is just such a volume on its own. But Vietnam is also fascinating. So if I had to cherry pick a few countries that here and there, I'd say maybe those three. And then you have Turkey as well. I mean, there's really a lot of exciting geographies too. I mean, when I think of Turkey, I think of Turkey and Argentina, and I think of so many outstanding entrepreneurs from very diverse sectors, because sometimes you see same sectors being represented by one country. So you have a lot of, it's a lot of logistics solutions based out of Colombia. You see a lot of that. And also fintech, other areas, but you see a huge part of that. And I guess has a lot to do with the Rappi effect. But it's fascinating to see that in Argentina or in Turkey, you have companies that are gaming, fintech, crypto, ag tech, it's really all over. So you have a huge concentration of just great entrepreneurial blood there now. But as I said, the sector that I'd say would be the ones I mentioned, and the geographies also those three. If I can actually extend it to 6, I would say the 6 that I highlighted.
Right. No, that's very interesting. And the global perspective, I love where you were going with this and taking the localized approach to a lot of these different markets. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. So as Endeavor, if I was to just to summarize, do you guys operate kind of in the accelerator capacity as you guys, take on these different founders, entrepreneurs? Is that more or less similar model?
We like to think of ourselves more of a community. I always describe it, if I had to describe it in one word, I would say it's a network. It's being part of the network. And you can use that network most likely to accelerate as well. But it's also to the point that you made before of, having successfully led companies, but also having successfully failed companies. It's also being able to learn from those failures and successes from, people that have done it in the past. So it's really a network that is there to be leveraged by our entrepreneurs. What we want to be able to provide them is with a network. No need to actually go elsewhere to actually nourish that network, because we already have it. We're plugged in 39 markets. We have board members. We have mentors. We have entrepreneurs. There's likely someone that's already been going through one of your pain points and different sectors and different parts of the world, and most likely can relate. So there's always interesting conversations to be had. By the way, those conversations can be cross sectors. So I always put a great example of an entrepreneur that we met and we mentored and was been onto some amazing things, was in the food business that had restaurant chains. And at one point in one of our events, he kicked it off with a digital entrepreneur, no? And the two of them became very close friends. And through many of the growth areas and hiccups that he experimented, it was this digital entrepreneur that had already experienced several others because he was a seed entrepreneur, actually mentoring this food entrepreneur, no? So as I said, it's more of the experience, because a lot of it has to do with talent and culture and you know, negotiating with partners, et cetera. And that part is, it doesn't really understand. I mean, that part is really sector agnostic too. So if when you're dealing with those kinds of issues, they're very common to 99.9% of entrepreneurs.
Right. No, that's very exciting. And, you know, I kind of almost, you know, a little bit jealous of some of the founders that get this opportunity to learn and be part of that network, because, you know, we did not have a lot of opportunities like this, you know, even, you know, 5-6 years ago when we were just starting out some of the companies. So that's super exciting. When it comes to innovation and you know, innovating your services, innovating your solutions that you provide to your network, talk to us a little bit from that perspective. How do you build that culture of innovation? Is a lot of your innovation within the lines of the different types of mentors that you bring on board and so forth? Curious to hear some of the examples.
So on the one side, our North Star is to add value to entrepreneurs. We always say that our first value is entrepreneur first. No? So we want to add value. So we're always trying to figure out what is that value that we can add? No? What is exclusive to us? No, I mean, if an entrepreneur comes to us looking for consulting, there's 100 firms that can do consulting. We have partners that do that much better than we do, and are, you know, have been trained for decades doing that. If they're asking us for other areas, there might be partners that we can actually guide them to. But from our side, what we're always looking to find out is how we can, one, get the entrepreneurs to open up and be able to open up to their problems and what they're dealing with on one side, and also being able to figure out how we can leverage what we have, you know, as far as networks go and as far as connections go, you know, because many times entrepreneurs are very much related with the entrepreneurs in their countries, maybe in their regional geographies, but not worldwide, not globally, you know, and being able to provide them with peers that are going through the exact same hiccups at the exact same time in the other point of the world, that is actually very, very, very extremely valuable. You know? So to that extent, the core of what we are is really a community. It's really a network. What we're trying to build all the time on, as far as the innovation part goes, is figuring out what is value add and what is top of mind for the entrepreneurs. You know? So always the first question is, what is, you know, keeping up at night, you know? And if based on that, on what's keeping up at night, you're telling me that it has to do with talent, we will try to dig into what are the key things going on around talent. If it has to do with raising capital, we will figure out what are the key aspects that we need to be able to consider, you know? But it's always trying to figure out under what bucket is it falling, you know? Is it markets as well? That's another common thread, you know? I mean, how many entrepreneurs are trying to figure out the way to access different markets? They might have been able to expand within their market. Now they're looking to expand outside their market. And within outside their market, they might have a global expectation, no? And to that extent, we can also, you know, figure out what we can do, no? But the idea here is always be able to figure out how we can be entrepreneur first. And our core innovation is driven by what we can actually look into our entrepreneurs and what the data from our entrepreneurs is telling us, no? So it's very important for us to be able to determine what type of entrepreneurs do we have? What are we attracting? How are they growing? To what extent? When I joined Endeavor 7.5 years ago, we had no unicorns in our portfolio of companies. No? Now we have well over 20, actually close to 30 unicorns. No, they have very different needs. They're growing at a very different pace. And not only that, they're generating tons of headlines. No, so they're gaining a lot of traction. And they're also getting a lot of eyeballs that are looking at them as those references in the local markets. No, so part of us had to actually, part of what we were doing had to actually pivot to a point in which, what are we doing for those entrepreneurs? No, because it's not the same to have a company that's grown from 5 million to 10 million to 20 million to 30 million than growing a company that is now valued at 1 billion. No, and to that extent, we created a subset of entrepreneurs called outliers. Now, we were able to do a strategic offering for those entrepreneurs. At the same time, we were able to analyze where these entrepreneurs were coming from and figure out what the pathways to that growth was. No? And based on those pathways, we could actually determine, well, we have the subset, which is very easy to determine. No? But we also have the ones that are leading to be there. What can we do for those as well? No? So we can actually now not only select these entrepreneurs, but then we can actually also kind of like identify in which phase we can add what type of value to which entrepreneurs now. And that's actually top of mind for us. We're always trying to think, what is it that we're seeing? What commonalities are we looking at? No, where can we group these entrepreneurs so that they're actually adding value to themselves? No? So it's, as I said, it's all based on our entrepreneur first mentality and just trying to, I mean, at the end of the day, Endeavor is backed by 500 plus employees that wake up every day wanting to add value to our entrepreneurs. No? And the fascinating part of that is that they're always embedded into the local ecosystems, knowing what's going on and understanding what their entrepreneurs are doing and what entrepreneurs in their network are doing. And just by doing that, we can actually figure out how we can add value to them.
Right. No, absolutely. And it's, you know, the power of a community, power of a network is paramount and oftentimes overlooked. So I think that's a very unique value proposition from that perspective. As you know, with coming out of pandemic, and I talked to a lot of different entrepreneurs, you know, investors, you know, technology executives, and one common thread that we always touch upon is all around war for talent out there, you know, the talent acquisition, because with so many opportunities out there for everyone in the virtual world, especially, war on retention, I guess, becomes also another layer of complexity when it comes to companies retaining the top talent. So talk to us a little bit about some of the strategies that you help some of your entrepreneurs when it comes to recruiting and, you know, surrounding themselves with the top performers, because in this market, yes, it's virtual. You have access to global talent, but at the same time, competition is 10x as well. Share your thoughts on that.
So it's interesting. That is the one thing that is constant, and it's become more of a constant in the last few months, last years. I mean, that's the one thing that we've been seeing. It's a huge focus on talent. It's interesting because whenever we think of the entrepreneurs, we think that their main focus is going to be around either capital or maybe markets. No, but it really is talent. At the end of the day, that's the core part. As far as the retention and attraction, so obviously we're operating in 39 markets that are very diverse. We're operating in some markets within the US, but we're also operating in the Middle East, in Africa, Europe, Southeast Asia, in Latin America. And each one of the markets, there are different trends. Now, in some markets, it's hard to find that talent. So it's not a matter of being able to retain it or be able to attract it. It's just be able to find it because there's not enough that trained talent. No? So that's the one thing there. No? So they're trying to figure out how they can actually upskill the talent that is available so that they can actually meet their needs. The good thing is that once they're able to actually get into that talent pool, no, in those markets, it's fairly easy to retain, no? Because there might be limited competition, or there's not as many tech companies coming up, no, or it's not as vibrant an ecosystem. In the ecosystems that are evolving, there is a constant war for talent, no, where the big fish are eating the talent from the small fish, no, so the small fish are actually getting the talent on board and training it, and then once they're at certain point, they're being quote unquote stolen from the larger competitors, no, and then you have the all out war that's going on in more developed economies, in which it's just they're being able to raise so much capital they can actually afford to actually invest more in their talent, and then there's just a talent war going on, and it's a fight for retention, no. The interesting thing here in the end is that most of it has to do with the culture that is emanating from the entrepreneurs, and it's actually from the founders and co-founders. It comes from the top, and that's basically what everyone's been trying to focus lately is being able to figure out a way in which they can foster that type of culture in which employees feel comfortable, employees feel they're growing, that they're being valued, that there's still an opportunity, that there is upside. No, so and there's all of that. In some cases, it's creating figures called stock options, which are so common in the US, but in other countries, it's almost impossible to structure, no? Or phantom shares, or however you might call them, no? So be able to give them something so that they might actually have skin in the game, no? And that way they can also figure out ways in retaining. In other ways, it's also being able to train the talent, no? And it's being able to figure out what are the training opportunities that they might have, no? Or being able to be much more much more public about, you know, the new talent that they're retaining and the new opportunities that they're developing within, and being able to promote their talent as a core part of their of who they are and what they are. You know? But at the end of the day, it is interesting that in this war of talent, the war of retention that you were mentioning, there is really no key. There's no key figure. I mean, I'd say that cultural part is very important. The one thing that we have noticed is that, and this is an obvious statement, but all those companies that have a much higher attrition, normally there is something off, there is something wrong. The companies that are able to retain talent for a short period and be able to actually figure out the way in which transitions can be a natural evolution, whatever that might mean. Those transitions could be 3-4 years, or it could be 5-8, no? But if they can figure out a way in which they can live with that and figure out the rotations, it works well. Now, the problem is when you're having way too many sudden departures in a very abrupt time frame and happening constantly, no? And we've seen that, and that is always the barrier to growth, no? So you got to figure out. I was speaking before about the multiplier effect, no? And how some early employees from the founding company from the that worked with the founder closely end up leaving to, you know, start up their own thing. Well, you know, some companies embrace that and they actually encourage that, and they fund their next next ventures. But some companies actually want to be able to bring that intrapreneurship inside. You know, so don't leave, stay. You know, and figure out how this area that you're seeing as an opportunity can be embedded into what we're already doing. You know, and you see some successful aspects there. You know, so you have intrapreneurs on the one side that are doing things internally, you know, and then you have the ones that just decide to leave and become entrepreneurs. But at the end of the day, the reality is that it has a lot to do with culture. It has a lot to do with also the geographies in which they're operating. Because when I have these conversations with different entrepreneurs in different areas, the war is not as cruel in one geography than another. In one of them, it's, yeah, I'm having problems. There is attrition. There is my talent does get poached. But at the other side, there's this all-out war, especially in the more developed markets.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah, you've nailed it right on the head in terms of, you know, that being a war out there. So in a sense, when the other component of hiring, you know, talent acquisition and retention is the whole interview side of things, because it's a very complicated aspect, and I haven't seen anyone just yet to completely nail down that particular formula to be really good at interviewing, because it's a combination of art and the science, and there's no specific formula for that, and it's very difficult. Share us your thoughts on overall just interviewing. How do you increase your chances, or how do you prepare your entrepreneurs as they interview others? Just share with us overall thoughts on the whole overall just interviewing.
Look, I think that you want to be as open as you can during the interview, because you don't want things to come out afterwards. And you want it to be as open on both ends, you know? So you want to be as natural and as realistic as you can be during the interview process. And you want the other person to actually also be able to open up and be able to figure out what might be a red flag, going forward, you know? So it's I think that the core recommendation would be just trying to keep it as natural as possible, trying to keep it as a conversation. I mean, there are certain things that you want to get out of the conversation. The qualifications, you can measure them with tests, and you can look at the resumes, and you can ask for references to your, you know, third parties. No, but the reality is that once all of that is met, it's much more about the individual. It's much more to be able to being able to connect with the individual and be able to have the person be able to open, as I said, open up. No, so the core thing I would say is conducting an interview as much as you can as a conversation, and not going down to the, oh, I have the three questions. Like, what color would you be if you were a color? What type of tree would you be? I mean, sometimes you have these questions that are kind of like completely, and they do get somewhere, and there's a lot of analysis behind the common questions and how you answer those common questions. But the reality is that you really want to be able to have a conversation, because at the end, you are going to be wanting to work with these people, and you're going to be wanting to get their feedback too. And in an organization which it's 50, it's fairly easy because it's somewhat contained. But in an organization when it's 1,000, you also want to be able to have, you know, people that can to a certain degree connect. And the same thing happens to the cultural part. No, you want that person to be able to fit into this culture, no, or to the culture that they're going into. No, so you want to be able to be as open, because is this someone that's going to fit into this culture, or are they going to be eaten up because it's way too competitive, or it's not, or it's way too outspoken, or it isn't. You know, so that's the kind of thing that you want to measure. But my rule of thumb has always been to try to obviously dive into as much as you can in those key executives. So if there's someone that's going to be your right, left hand, or very close in very close proximity to the leadership, I think that the leaders definitely need to invest their time in getting to know what they want to hire and do a deep dive. So getting to know what it is from a financial perspective that you're going to need from a CFO, what it is that you're going to need from a commercial perspective that you're going to need from the business development head, what it is from a marketing perspective that you're going to need from that marcoms person. No, and you really need to dive in and kind of like become almost that persona for a while, so that you can actually start interviewing and being able to figure out what you might need. And then you figure out what you need. And once you figure out what you need and you have those conversations, then you figure out who that person is, and there's going to be a cultural fit with the person, because that is the other thing, no? And I say that's the one thing that I always tend to recommend is don't leave this to luck. I mean, this is not one of those things that which you post out a job description and put on LinkedIn and then wait and see, because the likelihood of that being successful is relatively low. And normally you have to do a lot of deep diving and deep digging and figuring out. The great thing nowadays is that we have so many amazing tools. I mean, we have platforms, Workable, Indeed, so many platforms in which you can upload and have broader reach of your job description. But at the same time, you also have so many tools that you can actually investigate and figure out more about where that talent is and what kind of talent you might need. So LinkedIn is an amazing example. Now that you could just dive in and figure out what is the average CFO experience, and what are they doing, and where are they working, and what are my competitor doing, and what kind of profiles do they have. But it's fascinating because it provides you with insights that can able to give you a good sense of where you should go. But again, back to your question on the interview process itself, I'd say that the most important part you want to be able to figure out is how you can actually bond with that person, because if that person becomes part of your family, of your corporate family, you want them to be part of that culture, and you want it to be a very easy relationship and an easy dive. And that's the one thing that can go wrong really quickly if you don't measure it well.
Right. No, absolutely. I love these perspectives. And it's very challenging, the whole interview process, because at the end of the day, it's very hard to make that decision in such a short period of time to, select and hire somebody that you're going to spend, many, many years together. So I think there's so much opportunity to continuously learn from that perspective. So that's very interesting. When it comes to fundraising, that's, a very interesting area for me, because I've personally, when I was an entrepreneur, a startup founder, I've gone through multiple rounds of, fundraising, dealing with investors, venture capital, and it's an entire life on its own, because it becomes a full-time job, and you have to be familiar with every single term, not only how to pitch, but also, the different terminology in general. So just tell us a little bit about some of the strategies that really help you when you partner with some of the entrepreneurs in your cohorts or in your programs to succeed from the fundraising perspective, aside from the traditional pitch deck and all of the components of that. What are other areas that are oftentimes overlooked by entrepreneurs that you have observed in your, many years working with them?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because right now you've noticed this, I mean, there's an abundance of capital, those pitch decks have become, I wouldn't say irrelevant, but they're not as crucial as they were before. So it's more of being able to give a flavor of what the company is in that kind of deck, but you don't have to be as granular as you need to be at some point in the past. No, this is back to relationship building in the end. No, you want to be able to have good investors with you. You want to have not only the money, but you actually want to have the company. You know, so it's the whole thing about smart capital, and sometimes that capital doesn't necessarily need to be smart. As long as they're just not invasive or intrusive, they're not sending in the wrong direction. No, so I'd say that it's a bit of a dating game. No, with investors, in which you really want to get to know them as soon as possible. And if you're dealing with a Series A, but you've actually engaged very positively with a Series C investor, nourish that relationship. Don't say, well, I'll wait 3 years to actually nourish that relationship, 2 years, whatever it might be. No, because most likely you want to be able to have that in the long term. There's definitely things that you can always learn. But the one thing that we're always trying to encourage is for entrepreneurs to think strategically. It's not about raising capital at any cost. It's about raising capital strategically. It's what do you want to get from this capital? It's what are you going to do? And it's not only what are you going to do with the capital per se, but what are you going to do with that partnering that you're generating? Because at the end of the day, you are bringing someone else in a very important capacity to your family, you know? Because your employee, it is true. If it works, amazing. But if it doesn't work, you can always kind of let go. With your investor, if it works, it's great. If it doesn't work, let's just hope that it doesn't have a majority percentage, because if not, you can really be screwed, no? So that's the one thing you really want to get to know your investor well. I'd say that also a lot of due diligence is you know, worth doing. Speaking with other entrepreneurs that have been invested by those companies to be able to learn what the fit is, and getting to know a bit more of the back end. So I'd say that it's not only being able to lure the investor in and be able to seduce them with your pitch deck, et cetera, but also being able to know what is the story in the back end, you know. What do we know? How can we connect? And we do that a lot. That's a core part of what we do at Endeavor. Whenever an entrepreneur is raising a round, and they've lined up three or four investors, especially nowadays that the investors are actually going to the entrepreneurs versus entrepreneurs going to the investors, we're always being able to connect them with other entrepreneurs. The entrepreneurs can tell them, give them the feedback of, you know, this has worked, this hasn't worked. Careful here. They haven't had as much value there. They're outstanding. So.
Invest as an organization yourself, or you guys partner with other funds?
We invest. We do invest, but we are co-investment. We're a co-investment vehicle. So We invest in what we call a rules-based fund. And as I told you before, we are entrepreneur first. So we're always going to be about doing what's best for entrepreneurs. We don't want to generate any conflict of interest, et cetera. So what we did is we came up with this formula 8-9 years ago, in which, by the way, the fund is called Endeavor Catalyst. And what Endeavor Catalyst does is they invest in any Endeavor entrepreneur, one, that is raising more than $5 million, two, and that round needs to be led by an institutional investor, three. If those three requisites are met, we automatically will invest a 10% with a cap of $2 million. So our maximum would be $2 million per entrepreneur. But we do invest, but always as a co-investment tool and always with a very passive role. We would never be part of the board. We would never be, unless an entrepreneur tells us, I need you here, we will always be doing that. And not only that, we will replicate the lead investor's terms, and we will always speak with the entrepreneurs and tell them, no, what you're seeing as this is very common. Don't worry about this. This is, careful with these terms. So we will always be advising entrepreneurs, because our mantra is entrepreneur first.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that model. I think it's very unique value proposition, because at the end of the day, it's, you know, just having lived in the shoes of the entrepreneur for so many years, it's, you know, it's a different world. And when it comes to just the overall relationship with the investors, when it comes to the value add, how do each side views each other, I think it's just very interesting chemistry from that standpoint. So I love the model that you guys are building. The last portion of each episode, I love to focus on what are some of the sources that you utilize on a daily basis to educate yourself for self-actualization. Share with us, what is your content diet is looking like?
So my content diet, I'll tell you, I do a lot of, I've spoken about LinkedIn. I feel like I'm working for them part-time, but I do a lot of diving by the way, I'm not. I do a lot of diving into LinkedIn, because I find that I a lot of content is there, and a lot of people are sharing relevant content there. But as far as my content diet, let's see, I get the market snacks on a daily basis, and that's the one thing I consume. I get the Quartz daily newsletter as well, which I consume. There's a Spanish newsletter as well that's very specific to Spain, which I also consume. And then and that would be like on a newsletter perspective. I've actually tried to reduce newsletters because it was just cluttering my inbox, and I wasn't able to read through them all. There's others that I would recommend, but those are the ones that I highlight. And then I'm a very avid reader of The Economist, which I used to work for many years. But I try to read that from cover to cover whenever I can on a weekly basis. And then the obvious New York Times, Wall Street Journal as well. But not, I have to confess, not as much as I used to. So back in my JP Morgan days, I used to read Wall Street Journal quite religiously, and Financial Times as well. And nowadays, it's not as much. You know? So that would be my strict content diet. You know? And by the way, to that point, it's interesting because everyone tends to ask me, is there any book that you're reading as well? No. The fun fact is that there's no real book that I'm reading, just because I'm so determined on being able to read Economist cover to cover in the 7 days that it takes me. You know, so Thursday evening, I'm already downloading the digital version. I'm trying to get through it by Wednesday, because I already know Right. I'm already having it in the
cup. And it's very hard these days, so much information being thrown at us, to be so selective. And when it comes to books, I love books, but it's also the last, many books that I had started reading, I found myself that I have never finished any single one of them, because a lot of the books these days you can condense into maybe an article or two. So that's an interesting component. But the last point I want to ask is there a book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
Let's see. I mean, there's always several books. I mean, the hard thing of hard things, I think,
that's my favorite all time. You got that one.
That's the Bible. The last book that I actually did read, and it was not that long, it was a few months ago, was Life is in the Transitions by Bruce Feiler. That's the last one, which was interesting because this is a book that was actually written pre-pandemic, but it has a lot of great insights that would apply to the pandemic. So it has to do with life transitions, no? And that's the one thing my latest book that I read a few months ago. No? So that's the one. If I had to recommend a current book, that would be my most current. Fortunate thing is that it's from this year, so it's not technically actually from the end of last year. No, but so it's not a 1987 book. No. So.
Right. No, I love these recommendations. And for our listeners, we'll make those titles available in the show notes. Adrian, I can't thank you enough for your time today. It was very short, but very insightful conversation. We're definitely going to stay in touch. I love doing the follow-up episodes with all of my guests in about a year to see how much have transpired and revisit the conversation from a year ago. So I'm definitely going to do that with you. So I appreciate your time today.
Ben, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I always try to do I try to my best. English is my second language, although I spend over half my year in my years in the U.S. But I always feel that I'm not as fluid as I am in Spanish. So I hope that I was able to communicate.
I thought it was perfect. I thought it was perfect. I personally learned quite a bit. So definitely thankful for your time.
Perfect. Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.